Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Jacob Stigenga, who is reader in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge, and the author of two books, Care and Cure, Introduction to the Philosophy of Medicine, and Medical Nihilism, as well as many articles. And he's received numerous honors and awards. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I first just wanted to ask a little bit about your background and basically how you got into doing the philosophy of science.
Sure. So my first degree was in the sciences. I was studying molecular biology, biochemistry. In my final year, I took a few philosophy courses, including a philosophy of science class. And this really changed the way that I was thinking about science. And it was very inspiring to me. So this philosophy of science class really opened up a new world and a new way of thinking about science. I didn't change my path completely at that point, so I continued studying science, and I did a master's degree in physiology, and I worked for a while as an epidemiologist. But I kept thinking about those philosophy classes, and especially the philosophy of science class. And so at a certain point, I decided to do further graduate work in philosophy of science, and I finally committed to doing a PhD in philosophy.
In the in your book and in your lecture last night, where you discussed the book Medical Nihilism, you presented this argument about how, generally speaking, I believe we ought to have little confidence in the effectiveness of novel medical interventions based on small effect sizes, as you said, very few magic bullets, and problems of biased research. And I wanted to ask you, with that book specifically, but maybe more in general, working as a philosopher, I was kind of curious about how practitioners respond when you speak to them, or let's say, you know, doctors in this case. Like, I can imagine a range of responses, but I just have this idea that perhaps, you know, the practitioners might have a somewhat different mindset than, say, philosophers. And I'm curious about kind of the back and forth between those fields.
Sure, yeah. So, of course, I've gotten a range of responses, but on the whole, when I present this work to physicians, or I'll get emails from physicians who have read my book, the response has been, on the whole, overwhelmingly positive. And in some cases, I've had physicians who have argued that I'm not being strong enough in the book. I'm not making radical enough claims about medicine in the book. That's surprised me. Once in a while, I'll get a cranky message from a physician, right. You know, saying that I've exaggerated things. But on the whole, the response from practitioners has been exceedingly supportive and encouraging. A lot of the material that motivates the book, a lot of the arguments in the book, are based on things that I've learned from physicians, books that they've written, or shadowing their clinical work, or, you know, when I taught at the University of Utah, I had a psychiatrist sit in on a seminar I was teaching. So I've tried to get a lot of back and forth between philosophy of medicine and medicine. So on the whole, the response from practitioners has been positive.
The way the university is set up, or I know you've also had positions and fellowships at other universities, do you actually also teach, for example, pre-med students or medical students, or do they take your classes? Or
So at the University of Cambridge, I teach in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science, and we have a lot of students who are getting a science degree or getting a medical degree take philosophy of science classes, and so the short answer is yes.
Right.
I've had a few students who go on to do quite advanced work in, so a few medical students who go on to do advanced work in philosophy of science, either at the master's degree level or the PhD level.
And I guess a sort of another version of the question I just asked about practitioners. I saw that that you'd published some work in biology, for example, on the concept of population. Now, I have to admit, I didn't completely understand all of the argument, but my question would be, I guess, if you're in addition to medicine, you know, having worked with the philosophy of science, do you find that, let's say, you know, practicing biologists or biology students or whatever who have to, you know, I don't know, design an experiment or something, I was curious if they also give you feedback on things like that.
Right. Okay. So, you know, you were referring to one of my articles. You know, some of my work is more theoretical and more philosophical, and you know, other things that I've written are a bit more kind of on the ground, practical.
Yeah.
And of course, it's that latter work that gets more pickup from practitioners. And one thing that's been fun in the last few years in my work is that that I do get some take up from some of the things that I've written by scientists in various ways. So, it's one of the special things about working at Cambridge is that Cambridge has certain structural features about the institution that makes this happen more often than in other universities.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have this collegiate system in which you're often meeting people from different backgrounds, and then those people get interested in your work. And so this fall, I'll be giving a talk in a cancer researcher's lab because they'd heard about my book, and they thought that maybe I would have something relevant to say to them. One of my other colleagues in the college system is a well-known comparative animal cognition scientist who studies birds, and one of her PhD students is worried about some of the similar things that I'm worried about in medicine, but about the science of animal cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So that group is worried that some of the methods in comparative animal cognition research are biased, or there's a lot of publication bias, there's going to be a replication crisis.
Right.
And so they've asked me to work with them a little bit on what they're doing.
One of the, I believe maybe sort of towards the conclusion or kind of takeaway, and again in the book on medical nihilism and in your lecture, you talked about the idea of gentle medicine, which I understand to be something like being sort of cautious about doing too many interventions and is essentially being aware of all the things we don't know and so forth. And I'm sure you could probably define it much better than that, but I wanted to ask if, you know, given the range of kind of medical systems around the world, are there examples out there where you've seen let's say gentle medicine take place in a especially successful way, like places where we could look and say, well, yes, they're really doing it right as far as this kind of approach.
Sure, I think so. Yeah, so I think there are, of course, like cultural or national differences in how interventionist healthcare system is. In fact, I think one example might be one that comes from my own personal biography. So, a number of years ago, I tore a ligament in my knee. This was when I was doing my PhD in California, and the treating physician called himself a non-interventionist.
Right.
My response was, "What do you mean? I want my knee back."
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, "Well, there are these studies coming out of Scandinavia that compared the reconstructive surgery for this ligament to a protocol of physiotherapy and exercise and stretching,
yeah.
And those different groups, like the surgery group and the physiotherapy group, reached very similar endpoints, and that was pretty persuasive to me." And so, yeah, does that answer your question?
Sure, sure. I guess, you know, I maybe kind of a related to that, or kind of what was going through my mind, is a sense of, well, especially when you discuss the kind of the massiveness of the pharmaceutical industry and the studies and all these problems. My thought was, well, there's, you know, why is it like this? Well, there's, you know, there must be, you know, millions of patients, let's say with depression or something, people who desperately want something, you know, something to help, and then everyone involved, the companies and the researchers, everyone has this incentive. You know, basically I was thinking about the kind of incentive, like always everyone wants to do something and everyone has reasons, sometimes monetary or just otherwise. There's all these things that are pushing people to do something. And so it sounds like being gentle would be very difficult, because you have to kind of hold yourself back and say, and I was like, well, that's actually kind of a hard problem to say, well, how do you get everyone to kind of hold back from doing something? And so I was curious about like what it takes to actually make that happen.
It's a really important consideration. So as you say, the like motive force for intervening, especially for diseases which are, you know, lethal or life-changing, life-threatening, the motive force can be very powerful. So patients are desperate for intervention. Physicians are trained to intervene, and often there are, you know, institutional and legal constraints that incentivize intervention as well.
Yeah.
And so that's right. Like to affect a change towards less interventionism would require large-scale structural changes. To give a concrete example of this, one of my colleagues in psychiatry, I would call him a non-interventionist. I mean, he views his job as getting some of his patients off drugs rather than on drugs.
Yeah.
But you know, he works in a hospital setting, and he's constrained by various like institutional guidelines and financial constraints. He only has access to patients for a limited time.
Yeah.
And so there's only so much he can do given the broader context that he's in.
Yeah. There were in your lecture and so forth, there were a couple of different kind of problems or challenges, I guess maybe philosophical problems that you spoke about. For example, the naturalistic fallacy, and this idea of the underdetermination of theory by evidence, as I understand it, kind of examples of how it's essentially seems like it's very difficult to arrive at a clear sense of, well, this is what we should be doing. That's my understanding of it. Like, you have all this evidence, all this data out there, and it's very, very unclear of, you know, it doesn't just tell you, well, yes, we should do X, that's the clear answer. I guess the first thing that popped into my mind was, well, like, how to avoid, you know, just kind of throwing up your hands and saying, oh, like, it's, you know, I can't, I mean, like, what can we do? We can't do anything. Because that's obviously not what you argue for. But if you're talking to someone who's, I guess my question might be, if you're talking to someone who's not a philosopher, who's not an expert in any of these fields, and they say something like, oh, well, like, I just don't trust any of it. I don't trust doctors. I don't trust science. Like, you know, which I guess would be maybe like very strong nihilism, which again is not what you're arguing for. How do you kind of maybe thread that needle of saying, well, you know, be cautious, don't believe all the studies, etc., and yet don't just throw up your hands and do nothing. I mean, it's tough.
This is a really important consideration, and it touches on like really broad and disturbing trends in our society. So, you know,
right.
In our society, we have a kind of growing anti-expert movement.
Right.
There's a very pronounced anti-science movement in society. You know, people that doubt the science of climate change, people that claim that, you know, evolutionary theory is just a theory, and so on.
I was thinking of vaccines.
Yeah, the anti-vaxxers is a good example. Yeah, and so, you know, in my own work, I'm raising all of these reasons why we should be skeptical about large parts of medical science. And so there's this real worry that that will contribute to this more general anti-science sentiment and anti-medical science sentiment. And I really hope that that doesn't happen.
Right.
I guess the kind of simple response that I would offer is just to say, like, having specific reasons to doubt specific aspects of particular domains of medicine doesn't mean that we should be just through and through cynical.
Right.
There's a fact of the matter about whether or not this medical intervention will do blah, blah, blah or not, and we should be trying to promote the most reliable science that we can in order to discover whether or not that drug does blah blah blah.
Right.
My own view would be exactly the opposite of just kind of like cynically throwing our hands up in the air and saying, well, we don't know anything, we can't do anything. Well, no, right. No. We can know something about medicine, and we should do what we can to try to know it.
Yeah. One of the other things that that really struck me in your talk, as I kind of walked away, was this these kind of two different situations, I guess. On the one hand, this certain situations, and I think the example would be depression, where a condition is extremely complex, and I believe you showed it only for a moment, this kind of diagram or matrix of all the causes going into depression. It was mind-boggling. It was something like 20 or 25 different linked little charts on points on a chart, and each of them had a certain correlation, and I thought, this is, I mean, how intuitively, like as an ordinary person, like how could you possibly even begin to kind of understand what this is? It's so complex. And then the alternative, the kind of examples that you cited as typically as being very highly successful in terms of interventions, were where the the causality is very clear, and you talked specifically about infectious diseases where there's a virus or a bacteria that you want to get, or deficiencies, like if you're missing insulin or something like that. On the one hand, you've got something that's so complex that it's hard to even begin to understand it, and then on the other hand, there's the kind of very clear situation where there's kind of one thing that you want to get. And I'm curious. Well, I guess is that a fair way of kind of describing the range of situations that you're talking about? But the other part of the question would be do all the different examples that you're talking about kind of fall onto a continuum in between those? Like, there's different degrees of complexity, or can you sort of separate things out fairly easily into saying, well, there's the ones with the clear causal situation, and then the ones where it's too complex to even understand? I don't know if that makes sense.
Sure, no, I really like this question. it's a really good question. So the basic idea is, I was talking about this notion of magic bullets. You know, magic bullets are the kinds of interventions that we can use to target particular kinds of diseases. And as you just nicely reiterated, those diseases tend to be ones with a simple causal basis.
Right.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, I use as an example to illustrate the causal basis of depression. So as you said, I had on this graph this like really complicated causal diagram. And you're asking, are these two ends of a spectrum? Or are they like... And I think that's right, that we can conceive of the complexity of the pathophysiological basis of various diseases as on a spectrum. One end of the spectrum is something really simple, like having a bacterium in your body and you just need to get rid of that bacterium.
Yeah.
And on the other end of the spectrum would be something really complicated, like a disease of the mind, where we don't even know where to begin describing the causal basis of the normal state, let alone the abnormal state. And then we might have sort of intermediate cases, like say maybe an example would be maybe a leukemia, for instance, where it's still a complicated pathophysiological condition, but it's not as mind-bogglingly complex as, say, the pathophysiological basis of schizophrenia or depression.
In trying to understand kind of all the different in the history of medicine, the ways that people try to deal with, cope with illness, going back, to the beginning of history and so forth. I was thinking about this sense of how throughout most of history, I don't know, the layperson's example would be like leeches or something, that these things where people just do it, or even if modern science doesn't really accept it, but there might be there's this sense of like, I guess the way that placebos seem to be actually helpful somehow, or you know, the kind mm-hmm. of placebo effect. And I was curious if there's from within the field of philosophy, if there's any sympathy. I guess what I'm asking is, you know, things that seem kind of irrational or inexplicable, like, you know, are there philosophical reasons to say, well, yeah, you know, go ahead and like, you know, keep doing this thing, like, it doesn't really make any sense, you know, I don't know, leeches or crystals or something like that, alternative medicine, like, is there ever a reason to say, you know what, just like, go for it, just do that, you know, even if it's not scientifically legitimate. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I think it does make sense. There's a lot packed in there. So I guess I would approach things on a case-by-case basis. So, sure. I think a compelling case could be made that for some kinds of interventions, even if we have really little reason to think that those interventions are doing anything to modulate, like, the real pathophysiological basis of disease,
right,
that anyways they might be doing some other kind of good.
Yeah.
And insofar as they are, and insofar as they're not doing as much harm as they are good,
right.
Then we could consider thinking, you know, we could say that that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of consideration really becomes compelling when we bring in the placebo effect, as you mentioned.
Right.
We know that some diseases are very placebo responsive, and so we might as well try to take advantage of that, however we can. So if we can make people feel a little bit better using interventions for which we think are poorly justified on some kind of narrow-minded scientific ground, even if it's the case that we can make people better via a placebo response, then I think we ought to try.
Yeah.
And so, now all that said, you know, a lot of the arguments that I make in the book for doubting the effectiveness of mainstream medical interventions, I think apply even stronger
to
you know, alternative forms of medicine.
Right.
Now, that's a prima facie argument for not using them. On the other hand, many alternative medicines are like relatively low cost and relatively free of side effects compared to mainstream medicines.
Yeah.
So maybe their low cost and their dearth of side effects in conjunction with the potential for harnessing the placebo effect could be an argument in favor of using them.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this morning in the meeting of the Center for Values, you spoke a little bit about your next book, or I guess your current book project, is a philosophical philosophy of science-based investigation of sexual desire. And I was curious, it seems like it would certainly come out when you're working on this book, although I think in, I guess, the other work as well. Given all the challenges that we were talking about a minute ago, the underdetermination of theory and the naturalistic fallacy and all of that, I was left with the question: well, where exactly, in your understanding, kind of norms come from? I mean, the norms aren't, or norms are the sense of the good, I guess, sense of the good. Like, what's a good like society in terms of how it handles sexual desire, for example? We can't just say, well, as you're saying, like, we can't say, well, bonobos do it this way, therefore that's good, and therefore we should do it that way too. It's not that simple. Or you can't just say, like, that's, you know, that's purely, I guess, native naturalist account or nativist account, and then the purely constructivist account saying, well, it's purely social construction. If that's the case, well, how do you decide which one's good? I mean, it's obviously a very basic question, but like, how do you even start to say, well, this is what's good and this is what's not good?
Oh, gosh.
I know that's like a book length question, really, but
or it's a library question.
Yeah.
And, you know, many generations of philosophers have tried to answer the question, what is the good and where does it come from?
But maybe just like in terms of not to give you a complete answer, but just like for this particular book, like where do you even start? I guess you would say. Like,
yeah. So. Right. So the substantive questions that I want to try to tackle in the book are questions like, to what extent is there a nature to our sexual desire? Are our sexual desires like part of our sort of inborn human nature as a result of evolutionary biology, or are they like a product of social forces, cultural causes? Are there male-female differences in desire? Are our sexual desires consistent with or in tension with like social norms like monogamy?
Yeah.
And to a certain degree, I hope, although maybe this is naive, but I hope that I can try to tackle those substantive questions without being too committed one way or the other to a view about like where norms come from. Now, that said, there's still going to be this important question, like, suppose we learn a lot from, I don't know, studies of bonobos about bonobo polygamy.
Right.
And then one wants to make the inference about how humans should structure their socio-sexuality. Somebody could still come along and say, like, look, there's just nothing we can learn about this normative question about how we ought to organize our social and sexual lives from animal studies, because that's a normative question, and
right.
we can answer that normative question as we wish, where the wish comes from like political and moral considerations rather than empirical facts about bonobos. I think that's pretty compelling.
I guess another aspect that I was curious about had to do with, I guess, and I'm sure, again, this is probably another library length question, but in terms of method, I imagine that there's kind of the, you can choose, I imagine, a more individualist or more kind of social account. What I mean is, you can say, well, like, you know, my sexual desire is something about me, like it's in my head, or it's in me or whatever, and it's about kind of how I exist and relate to the world, and try to kind of solve that challenge. But on the other hand, you could say that in any society, like everyone's own sexual desire also affects in some way really everyone around them. And you know, if there's, you know, if we think of like a wedding, for example, like that's how, you know, like everyone there is somehow involved in kind of ratifying that, you know, ceremony and so forth. So like I said, I'm sure it's a library length question, but how, you know, I guess how do you begin to approach the problem of reconciling the sense of how each person deals with their sexual desire versus how that, you know, how that's organized socially?
Yeah. No, this is another really important question because, on the one hand, features of our sexual desires are so important to us that they form our identity, so to speak, right? For instance, a person's, at least in modern Western society, a person's sexual orientation is like a core feature of their identity. And so there's something very sort of individually important about a person's sexual desires, or seemingly so. On the other hand, so some people worry that, on the one hand, our desires indeed are the product of social and cultural forces that transcend the individual.
Right.
And so when I say to myself, well, my desires are like such and such, they have features A, B, C, and D, it might be sort of on its face true that they have features A, B, and C, and D, but they have those features because of the social context that I'm in.
Yeah.
Then there's this further worry about having like first person introspective access to what our desires in fact are.
Right.
So some people say, well, that's the only way we can know what our desires in fact are, is just to sort of ask ourselves, like, what do I desire? But other people say that we have poor introspective access to our desires. And so simply like introspecting is not a reliable way to learn about what our desires are. And that's for a variety of some people argue that this is for a variety of basically masking effects that society can have, or that like psychological repression can have.
Right.
I don't have settled views on any of these questions, but you're certainly putting your finger on like a really important tension that in this new work I'm going to want to try to grapple with. Yeah.
I think I sort of asked something related in the discussion this morning, bringing up this novelist Michel Houellebecq, who has written these works of fiction that kind of describe a very dystopian version of this kind of, I think you might call it a liberal or neoliberal sexual marketplace, where it's a kind of pure competition, and as a result, lots, you know, there's a few winners and a lot of losers and so forth. That's just one example, but I was curious, since again there's probably countless possibilities, if there are works of literature or fiction or drama. And this is my background in the humanities coming out, whether there might be kind of, novelists or playwrights that you've come across as perhaps maybe dramatizing some of these questions about desire in a particularly interesting way, kind of.
This is an interesting question that I haven't thought about, so I don't have a kind of off the
cuff. It's fine if you do.
Answer. Let's see. The filmmaker Wong Kar-wai, has depicted aspects of desire and beauty and sensuality in ways that I find interesting and compelling. That's one example that comes to mind.
It just, it seems like there's, I guess the reason I ask the question is because, how do I put it? The sense that, other people are such mysteries, even if I'm talking to someone, or if I think I know them well, there's so much about them that I have no idea about. And in particular, in the case of sexual desire, I mean, with social norms, like we know nothing or almost nothing about almost everyone we speak to, and therefore like for these kind of accounts of what is it like to be, X? I guess, for example, like for the case of like a female perspective, being male myself, like if I'm reading a literary account written by a woman or I suppose from a very knowledgeable male author, from kind of fleshing out a kind of female character, that somehow gives me a better sense of like what it's like to be in that position than I would have even just by talking to someone. But it almost seems like too big a problem to even think about.
Well, but I really appreciate this line of questioning for a number of reasons. You're mentioning how. One reason why the topic of sexual desire is interesting for me as a philosopher is that, as you say, our desires are very mysterious, and the desires of another person are virtually unknown to us, and sexual desires are the kinds of things that are deep and mysterious, sometimes wonderful, sometimes dark and troubling.
Yeah.
And so it's this kind of rich world of possibilities. And then there's this question of how can we learn about the desires of other people, given how sort of dark and mysterious they can be, and given how social norms constrain are like expression and manifestation of our desires, and that is a huge problem. Now, empirical science, like, there are many research programs in the empirical study of sexual desires that try to get around some of these problems, that try to employ methods that that give us some access to people's wonderful, deep, dark desires. So obviously one thing that I want to do as a philosopher of science is try to learn from that empirical literature.
Yeah.
But another important aspect of your consideration is one about one's own identity. One worry that I have about this work is that I myself have like one particular kind of identity. You know, I have a particular gender and I have a particular orientation, and that identity could shape and inform the philosophical work that I do on this topic in ways that are constraining and limiting, and potentially so much so that the product might be either like unfamiliar or uninteresting to people, or in the worst case, like offensive and harmful to people. And so I want to do whatever I possibly can to try to avoid that. One sort of research strategy, which I think you were maybe hinting at, was to try to use other kinds of forms of knowledge to inform the perspective that I'm taking. And that could include fiction. That could also include basically just trying to get other sorts of people to open up to me or to read my draft work. I think it's really important on this kind of topic, because our desires are so wrapped up in identities, I think it's very important to try to get as many voices involved as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. While you're talking, I thought of these other examples. With my own perspective on literature and so forth, I was thinking, well, there's all these extremely popular kinds of literature that I guess are especially marketed, not exclusively to women, and are especially popular. I'm thinking of like vampire novels, or even in particular like the 50 Shades of Grey, that whole series. I thought, like, I would never have predicted, like, in my own little bubble, like, oh, those aren't all that important, let's say. But if like millions of people are buying them, like, I feel like there's something there that I would never have known. But anyway, what you said makes a lot of sense. I guess my final question would be, I mean, we were speaking about this particular book project, but I was curious whether if there's other future research that you're planning at this point, or is that the main thing that you're working on?
Oh, so last year I was on sabbatical, and I was trying to decide what sort of large-scale project I should commit to. I enjoy many philosophers and philosophers of science work on a kind of article-by-article basis.
Right, right.
They choose a topic for a few months or a year, and they write that article, and then they move on to the next topic. And I've done a lot of that in my career, but I really have enjoyed having a book-length project in front of me.
Right.
And so I spent some time last year on sabbatical toying with a bunch of different ideas, and this one emerged as the one that I was ready to commit to. I have a few other projects in mind that might warrant a kind of book-length treatment. One goes as follows. In philosophy of science in the last generation or two, there have been two really important trends that I find impressive. One is the employment of formal logical tools to provide rigor to the study of science.
Right.
And the other is the study of science in practice, the study of scientific issues on the ground that matter to scientists and to society. And on the whole, these two trends have developed independently of each other. And in a few sort of article unit lengths of work, I've tried to fuse these trends. And I've been thinking about writing a book that puts that kind of philosophical method center staged, fuse these trends of formal philosophy with applied philosophy of science.
Cool. Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today has been Jacob Stigenga, the author of Medical Nihilism. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Find out more at athenaeumreview.org.